Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message. Today, we hear from Kent Dobson as he shares on truth in the age of anxiety. Please check the description for links to our quarterly Spotify playlist and guided meditation.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Eastlake. I'm Kent Dobson. I'm excited to be teaching again today. If you tuned in last week, I gave a little talk. I gave a little chat on what I called courage in the age of anxiety. And I hope you heard a hint, a guess, a clue, something to sustain you in this wild thing we call life. And what does Mary Oliver say? What will you do with your one wild and precious life? Well, hopefully find ways to live courageously and wholeheartedly is what I meant. And I want to weave a similar thread. Today I want to talk about truth in the age of anxiety, that troubling little single syllable word, truth, the kind of word that makes many of us uncomfortable. It's something we, I think, both desire and are feel a little unsure about at the moment. And I think it's part of the age we're in. And I want to try to look at it directly, not that in the next half an hour, I'm going to, you know, seal the deal on truth and everything will become, you know, crystal clear. And we'll all understand the truth and we'll be set free. Rather, I want to be in relationship with this word and talk about a certain kind of posture toward what's true. So that's kind of where I'm heading. And maybe I want to repeat something in case you missed last week about why I'm calling it the age of anxiety. I'm using anxiety in a very specific way. Not that I have the, you know, the final say on what anxiety is, but what I mean by it in this context is this sense of dis-ease that we are carrying personally, and I think culturally, sort of there's a individual component and a collective component. It's a dis-ease that doesn't appear to have a single source. That's the way I'm using anxiety. Now, sometimes anxiety can be caused directly, but sometimes that's might better be called fear. Like we might fear something directly, but anxiety is, the way I'm using it now, is like this low level, very low level dis-ease that can deflate us and leave us in a kind of fog. And my suggestion is we're in that kind of age. And anyway, the rates of what we think of as depression and anxiety and PTSD and suicidal thoughts, and they're on the rise. I mean, are among all of us, like we're feeling psychologically and spiritually fragmented. And at least one of the very small reasons why it can be important to be connected to a spiritual community of some sort, or a community that has a kind of spiritual depth, is that it helps contain or hold or hold that kind of fragmentation. Sometimes it can give us a lever and a place to stand, like in the Archimedes myth. In any case, I want to talk about truth in this present age of dis-ease. And it's kind of, you know, in some ways, maybe the place to begin is just to talk about our kind of cultural dis-ease with the word truth. I mean, after all, now suddenly we're in the era of misinformation. What a funny word. Like, I never used that word 10 years ago. I don't even know if it is a word, technically speaking. Or disinformation, and what is the difference? And well, not that I want to define that right now, but it's sort of like saying you can't trust information. There are different kinds of information, and there all are alternative facts. Remember that? Alternative facts. And in the very politically and socially polarizing, at least according to mainstream media, country that we live in, that's what they're always promoting. We're more divided than ever. And of course, you always want to maybe put a little question mark there. But at the very least, in that kind of culture, it's like you can't trust the other side. You can't trust any of the information. You can't trust what they say. You can't trust what's true, other than we can be assured that the other side is not telling the truth. And not to mention, you know, we live in this kind of, I don't particularly like this word, but I don't know of another one, but is the post or the after modern era that we're in now, where there's still a mixture of scientific rationalism and enlightenment very deep in our collective psyches about how to find the truth. You know, truth is scientific and verifiable and objective, and of course the perspective of the observer, which now we're becoming more and more aware of, is now coloring our capacity to name that. Just knowing that the observer has a bias and an opinion and a lens clouds our capacity to say for sure, this is the truth. So that's kind of the era we find ourselves in. And of course, it's getting worse. And even words are starting to, there's some slippage there. We don't know what people mean anymore by very basic words. And oftentimes the culture delights in throwing ambiguity at these long accepted definitions for words, often leaving us with a sort of vague notion that, well, truth is relative. It's like that Bright Eyes song. You gotta think of the line. He says, you say there's no truth, and who cares? How come you say it like you're right? You know, that's a funny, kind of clever observation. There's definitely no truth. And you say it with conviction, and that's kind of a funny irony. It collapses in on itself. It's like the, at least a portion of the culture wants to say there is no absolute truth, and that is itself an absolute claim. And so we're like caught up in this spin cycle of sort of madness. And maybe my point right now is that I'll just borrow a little bit from Ken Wilber. I've been a student of Ken Wilber for a long time, and I think that's the only thing I'll ever be, is just a student. I can't, certainly will not become a master of his work, which is very rich and complex. But he has a new book. I actually got some sort of pre-copy of it, and this might be the title of it now, but it was something like Truth in the Post-Trump Era or something like that. It may have been massaged a little bit, but it's out now, and you should definitely read it. It's definitely worth reading. He tries to look at the present age we're in terms of consciousness, collective consciousness, personal consciousness, and through the lens of spiral dynamics and a few other things. Anyway, but he says we live in the age of narcissism and nihilism as it relates to our relationship with truth. Because sort of the fundamentalist clinging to truth is, you know, I know that I know that I know, which is a line from, you know, we used to say as Baptist kids, sort of rigidity around fundamentalism, I know the truth. And its opposite extreme, which is, it's some sort of arbitrary linguistic construct. Those two extremes, which are having their say right now, has an effect on us. And for many of us, it leads to a kind of nihilism, like a meaninglessness. And the funny thing about nihilism is that it says there's no meaning, which again is kind of an absolute claim, which is a structure of meaning. You know, well, I guess it's meaningful because there is no meaning, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm convinced from my own point of view, I guess, nihilism is no way to live. And it's certainly not a life-giving, life-generating way of being, even though I'm attracted to it at times. I can feel it rising up. And narcissism, the other, he calls this the cul-de-sac, Ken Wilber calls it the cul-de-sac of nihilism and narcissism. Narcissism, you go round and round. And narcissism is exactly what it sounds like. I mean, he's borrowing from the Freudian use of the narcissist myth, which narcissist is the one who stares into the his own reflection and falls in love with himself. This is the me culture. This is the cult of my feelings and my image, how I present myself to the world, and even a cult of identity. Like, this is how I identify and this is how I show up, and that can often, though not always, be like looking in the narcissistic reflection and falling in love with a kind of illusion. And of course, narcissism has its own, wreaks havoc, has its own effects on culture, wreaks havoc when the whole world then, in the madness of uncertainty around words like truth, I'm just going to operate as if I'm the center of the universe. So one is an obliteration of meaning, where I'm just lost in the greater cosmos of meaninglessness, and the other is a kind of focal point, as if I'm the sun and everything else revolves around me. And often this is rather unconscious. I mean, there are a few people where we would say they're narcissists and they're aware of it, which would be kind of amazing, but most people are not. And when we're caught into it, because it's really an archetypal energy, not like a definition, a technical clinical definition that you can place on people. I mean, I know narcissistic personality disorder can be defined by the whatever. I'm not going to get into all that, but I'm using it a little more loosely, and I think Ken Wilber is too. We are prone to this. We're caught in this in some way. So that's a bit of the terrain that we find ourselves in. And let me just ask a series of questions here at the beginning, and I'm going to ask a series of questions at the end. Here's a funny one. I think it's funny. You probably won't find it that funny. Do you believe, or do you think, that you have false beliefs? Do you think you have false beliefs? Well, you know, part of me, if you were to ask me that, do you think you have false beliefs? Part of me wants to say, no, I don't have false beliefs. Of all the people on earth, I don't have the false beliefs. Other people have false beliefs. But you can't even say that with a straight face. It's like, well, probably is the answer. Yeah. Most likely, I have false beliefs. And I think that's an important starting place when it comes to a conversation around truth. Because it's sort of like saying, whatever it is, I'm probably not in full possession of it. My beliefs, my ideas, my ideology, my faith structure, I'm going to put a little question mark by it. It's possible that I'm wrong, like the great Radiohead song, I Might Be Wrong. And I think that's a necessary entry point or on-ramp to the conversation around truth. Okay, so it's possible that I have false beliefs. It's also possible that other people have false beliefs and don't look at the world. Their view of the world doesn't correspond to the way things are, or what we would call reality, I suppose. So that's one question. Here's another question. These are more philosophical, obviously, here at the beginning, but does our perception of reality correspond to something real? And we don't need to get caught in the weeds here, like a deep philosophical discussion about this, but does my perception of reality correspond to something real or not? Or is it just my perception of reality? That's the thing that's real. And it's a complicated question. And I'm probably not the one to even host such a discussion. It's really an existential philosophical question, and I'd have to look to the experts. But I think for the layperson like me, it's important to ponder. Well, I don't know if I'm that comfortable with saying the only reality is my perception. You know, that's sort of like saying, if you take a small child that believes in Peter Pan as a real thing, we would say, okay, that is their perception, or whatever, Saint Nick. that is, and that's real for them. Does it correspond to reality? No, it doesn't, not in the way we understand that. So it sort of puts forth a much more kind of primitive, magical way of thinking, if you follow the line of thought that my perceptions are reality. I want to say, no, I hope my perceptions correspond to something that's real, or there's a relational dynamic between what's real or ultimate reality, capital R, and my capacity, limited capacity, to understand that or to be in conversation with that. Here's another question. If the truth exists, or if truth exists, what's a healthy posture toward it? That's probably, at least for me, the most important question as it relates to truth in the age of anxiety. Okay, so if it exists, even if we have question marks about our capacities to fully know it or possess it or be certain and things like that, well, what kind of posture is helpful? Kind of posture is helpful? And that's a spiritual question, I think. I'll come back to that one later. And here's a question. What happens to the world, to cultures, really what it means, civilization and cultures, where the pursuit of truth is no longer a value? The pursuit of truth is no longer a value. That truth is just either very privatized, and your truth is your truth, and my truth is my truth. Very privatized. Or some other, you know, more older, archaic, sort of set in stone, it was said once and that's the end of the story. But what's my point right now? What happens to a culture when the pursuit of truth is no longer valuable? And I think it's a little like that right now. Like wanting to know the truth or pursuing it, especially pursuing it with a certain amount of humility, we might say, that doesn't appear to be a value. It's like, I know for sure, this happens in politics, that the other side is wrong, and all of the information is going to confirm my bias. I mean, that's what an algorithm is. I mentioned that last week. It's confirmation bias on like Adderall or something. It's just, you know, this hyper flood, torrent of information confirming our bias. That's an algorithm, and that's the way we treat so-called truth. We know it, and the other side definitely does not know it. And the pursuit of it, like putting one foot in front of the other, was something like, I might be wrong and I'd like to know something I don't presently know. It doesn't appear to be a value right now. And I say that's a major problem. It's a major problem culturally. And spiritual communities, I think, can aid in that. Healthy spiritual communities can aid in correcting some of that. Places like Eastlake or C3, where I'm a teacher, I think we have a value of openly inquiring into something. And that requires a certain amount of I know and I don't know, and this back and forth.
Hey everyone, it's Kristen. Just wanted to take a moment to say thank you for tuning in. I hope that you're finding these messages helpful for you in your everyday life. That's what we're trying to do here, is gather around the idea that life is a gift and love is the point, and let's give ourselves ways to move forward in that in our own everyday world. So I wanted to take a moment to say thank you for being a part of this community. To those of you who have participated and given financially, we want to say thank you to you. Everything that we do here happens because people make contributions. People say, I value this place. I want it to exist for me and for other people, and so I'm going to support it. And so we just want to say how grateful we are that you do that. And for those those of you who maybe haven't had a chance to contribute yet, we would ask you to consider maybe doing so. If you find this place beneficial, if you find these messages helpful for you, then consider joining us in that way. You can go to eastlakecc.com to make a contribution, and we just always are thankful for the people who want this place to exist. So thanks again for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
So, okay, here's the fourth question, then I'll get into some details here. Is truth more of a relational dynamic than a propositional statement? Here's something I wonder. Is truth, and maybe you could even say the pursuit of truth, more like a relational dynamic? Like, how am I related to truth? Let me add to that. How am I related to what's real? How am I related to reality as best I can in all my human frailty? What's my relationship with the truth? That might be more important than what propositional statements are true or false. That has a value. Of course, that's part of human consciousness, part of the thinking ego, we could say. It certainly has value, but just a cold statement, a propositional statement, doesn't tell us all that much about how then we are to relate to that propositional statement. So when I'm talking about truth, I'm wondering about our relationship with it. Like, I'll give you some examples from kind of my world, my graduate school and the intellectual, I suppose, world that I came from, which is biblical studies and comparative religion. And like, here's a statement about the Bible. So some would claim it's God's word, and others would claim it's not God's word. So there we have two propositional statements. It's God's word or it's not God's word. Now, I don't want to get in too deep technically, although there is value in this, in defining what we mean by God or what we mean by word and so forth and so on. Let's just take them as kind of general statements. It's God's word, therefore reliable and true, we could assume, or it's not God's word. It's the word of someone else or human beings and therefore not reliable or not true or clouded by human agendas and biases and things like that. So those are typically, that's really a 19th century, 20th century question. I think it's not solved in the 21st century, but that question really came into fashion in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, inside the world of biblical studies, we could say, which eventually trickles down everywhere else. But okay, there's the proposition. But the Bible is like a little more complicated than that. I'm not sure if that even answers the question of how do we relate to these statements, or how would we relate to either the Bible being true or not being true. That's the angle that I think is left kind of outside of a more cold propositional approach to truth. So so what we could say about the Bible, for example, is that it's sort of like a series of stories that sits inside a larger web of possibilities and connections. And one of those is science. One particular thread in the web is science. And you'd say, oh, it's God's word, definitely God's word, and therefore it's true. And therefore, when it says 6 days of creation, then that's what happened. God was up there, and apparently there were days even before days were created. And therefore, 6 days laid out, and really quite simple and straightforward, we would say. But that's just one particular thread. And what are the other threads of the Bible? Well, in how is it related to a question like truth? Well, we have to bring in science and theology and history. There's lots of historical details in there. Mythology, it comes from a world in which myths and stories and legends were floating around. We have to look at it through the lens of literature. I mean, after all, the Bible is not a book, it's a series of books, and inside each of those books there are different genres of literature, and genres of literature have to be looked at differently. A poem is read differently than you know, some kind of chronicle of what kings were up to, you know, or it's like a parable is different than a letter written to the churches. I mean, you wouldn't say the parable of the Good Samaritan is not true because it didn't happen. You know, you say, wait a minute, we need a different relationship with a word like true then. What do you mean by it's not true? And then we have to bring in psychology and as another thread, and then you have to bring in the writer, and then you have to bring in the reader, and then you have to bring in the present reader, and you know, you could even bring in the history of interpretation, because any kind of reading of anything, there's a measure of interpretation happening. And then you have to bring in linguistics and language studies and grammar and syntax. And, you know, I'm now hopefully showing you that a question of, is the Bible true? Is it not true? Is it God's word? Is it not God's word? Well, it's more complicated than that. And so a better question is, how are we related? If the Bible is itself related to truth, capital R, reality, we could say, what is ultimately true in there? Well, that requires a complex relationship. It's, take the story of Jonah, for example. If you only read it through a scientific lens, it's pretty unlikely that a man was swallowed by a fish and lived in the belly for 3 days and wrote a poem while he was down there. That seems a little unlikely. And especially if you ask, well, what kind of literature is this? Perhaps this is a kind of parable or myth. And when I say myth, I mean something positive. Most people mean something negative to me. That's a compliment. It's a story that tells the truth in ways that history can never get close to. Well, then we dismiss the whole thing. We dismiss the entire point of a story, or the several points that a story like that is making, is if we only leave it to a single frame for the question of truth. And we have to say, no, isn't it sometimes the case where we head in the wrong direction and speedily in the wrong direction, and then we get thrown overboard of our own life and turned upside down, and the way we thought things were going to happen doesn't happen, and it's almost like we descend into the underworld and we're swallowed, and it's almost as if we die and our way of life is taken from us? And yet somehow in the mysteries of that kind of suffering, there's also a sort of luminous dark light that shines, and kind of a new dawning. And it's like we get spit onto another shore and we're not even sure how we got there. And we'd say, yes, all of that is profoundly true about the nature of transformation. And that's what the story of Jonah is about. And that's partly what makes it profoundly true. So to have a relationship with what is true means we have to have a certain amount of existential and epistemological, we could say, use a fancy word, humility. How do we know what we know? Well, it requires a certain amount of humility, and we'd say something like the stories of the Bible point toward what's true, which maybe stands even outside the individual words or the frames or the propositions or the narrative arc. You know, like the Buddhists say, a finger pointing to the moon or something. So, now, back to the cultural question. Again, the nihilistic, I think, modern, postmodern tendency is to say there is no ultimate truth. And I would rather hold on to that. I'd rather say probably there is, and it's more of a question of how do we relate to ever-widening circles of coming into contact with what might be true about the way things are, about reality. I want to live a life where right now, compared to a month from now, or a year from now, or 10 years from now, if I make it that long, I'm coming into deeper relationship with what's ultimately true about what's real in my own life and in the life of culture and community and family. And I'd like to believe that and set a course and a posture toward that aim, all the while holding a certain looseness to it, a certain amount of unknowing, and saying, I'm just a human being. I don't want to pitch the whole thing in the trash and either serve myself with a kind of narcissistic me first, feeling first, only vision, or a nihilistic meaninglessness. So, okay. What do I want to ask now? Well, how do we stand in relationship with the possibility of truth, capital T or small t, any kind of truth? How do we stand in relationship to it? Which means at times we have to say, I don't know, and you don't know, and we don't know. And I want to have a certain posture toward that not knowing that will open me up rather than keep me closed. Why would we be closed to the truth? Well, because who wants to be told their beliefs and ideas and ideologies and statements and long-held beliefs or what people have faith in is in fact not real or not the case or doesn't correspond to reality with a capital R? Who wants to be told that? It's very challenging to the ego, especially. Maybe not so much to the soul, to the deep self. The deep soul might rejoice. Finally, the masks and illusions of the ego are being taken off like blinders, and thank God. But the ego, meanwhile, is freaking out. It doesn't like that. It's like, it's very uncomfortable because it's invested in its view of reality. And so I think part of the spiritual posture that's needed is one that's willing and open to having some masks taken off. And I think that's where spiritual communities like East Lake can come in and say, we'd like to be the kind of place that would say, we're probably wearing masks and we'd like them to be removed. We probably have blinders on and we'd like them to be removed from time to time. Not that we're here to remove everyone's blinders, but rather to put yourself and myself in a participatory role with that. I might be wrong, and I want to be in relationship with that dynamic. I live my life in widening circles that move out across the world, says Rilke, and I want to be living in that ever-widening spiral of more coming into the horizon and a deeper sense of what's ultimately true in the world. So, how do we stand? What kind of posture do we need to be in relationship with truth like this? And let me actually add a little aside here. And it comes from the Greeks. So as you know, I mean, philosophy, which is the love of wisdom, not so much truth, but the love of wisdom, was made popular really and came into fashion and helped shape the Western world from the Greeks. And not that other cultures didn't care about wisdom, they did. All cultures had and have wisdom traditions and love the wisdom of the ancestors, of the ancient ways, we could say. And the Greeks in particular had a whole elaborate underworld and gods and goddesses as a way of describing reality, both psychological internal reality and the external cosmos. And one of the things that I find powerful is that truth in Greek is not only the word has a certain meaning to it, but it was also connected to a place conceptually. And that place was in the underworld. And that place in the underworld was a river. And that river meant memory. So let me say it again. Truth to the Greeks was an underground river of memory. That to me is so powerful. It's like, oh. Isn't it sometimes like that? Like when you can't remember something, it's sort of like saying, I don't know what the truth is. Like take something simple. I can't remember where I put my keys. And then you remember. And so you're therefore encountering the truth and you turn and there they are. And it's like, oh my God, you know? Silly example, but it, I think, powerfully describes what the Greeks were getting at. That to really find the truth is to remember what's always been the case. And I like to think about truth that way, especially in the cacophony of noise. That's pop culture right now, media culture. It's a cacophony of loud, screaming, endless, static-filled noise. And sometimes I want to despair, but my conviction, I think, coming from sort of the secret wisdom of the Greeks is that beneath all that crap, there's the underground river still flowing, just silently. Like, I don't know if you've ever been to the desert. I've seen this in places like Anza Borrego, or Joshua Tree, or certain places in Arizona where, especially during certain times of year, you'll see a stream that will be trickling and then it will go underground. And you think, oh, that's where it ends, but then it'll reappear later on. It's kind of like that. It's like, well, whatever is true sometimes goes underground from our egoic stance, we could say. It goes underground, and the truth is like that. And it's a flowing river of memory. Now, beautifully, I won't go into all this, but the Greeks also imagined that the underground river of memory birthed the nine muses. The muses were things like poetry and dance and art and literature and myth. And I don't remember all nine right off the top of my head, but we think of that as the creative arts. That where do they come from? I mean, talk to any writer, and if you really start asking them, how did you come up with that? If it's any good, they'll say something like, I don't really know. It was like the muse whispered to me and I went with it, and we had a dialogue, and it was like a love affair, or sometimes a love-hate affair with the muse. And I seemed to be inspired, which means to be inspirited by something. And amazingly, from the Greek framework, the muses, the best art, the best poetry, the best dance is connected to truth. To the underground river of memory. It's like remembering something that's always been the case, and here it is being born again anew in this particular form and shape. Perhaps, I mean, as an aside, in the cacophony of static that wants to sell you something, we need art. We need artists. We need those who are taken by the muse and by truth, by the river of memory. Okay, that was an aside. Okay. So I'm gonna say one little thing that takes an attempt at defining, if I haven't already, by my various musings on truth, that I'd like to say something that truth is a way of describing the absolute, or truth is a word that's related to the absolute. Like, what is absolutely true, or sometimes I just like to say, what's real? What's really, really real? And truth is our word that is getting us there. It's saying, well, when we find the truth, it connects us in some way relationally to what's real. That's a conduit to what's real. But as soon as you say that, I think you also have to admit, and this is what the great mystics and teachers and wise sages and medicine men and medicine women have always been telling us, is that you can't possess that thing. You can't possess reality. It's like you can't possess the truth. It slips through your fingers somehow. It's like the moment you say, I've got it, it's mercury. It flows through the fingers again, and that's the way it should be. And that gives us a clue about the kind of posture that's needed. It's not a posture of throwing your hands up and what can we know? We can't know anything, or I'm just gonna stick with my, my ego assumptions. Not that people say that, but it's much more like I want to relate. I want to be related to what's ultimately the case, knowing I can't possess it. So it's like knowing and unknowing have to hold hands. What does Socrates say? Socrates was considered the wisest man who ever lived because he said, I know that I don't know. Okay, so there it is. There's a taste of the paradox there. And that paradox gives us a clue about the posture. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And there's a kind of freedom by saying the looseness of things. I know that I don't know. There is a kind of freedom in that, a kind of subtle freedom. All right, so I'm gonna offer Three things that I'd like to suggest we need more of right now. And here they are. They're kind of, I don't know, in some ways simple. Here's number one. We need to avoid simplistic exaggerations. We, and I'm really speaking to myself, I need to avoid simplistic exaggerations. Our culture is addicted to words and phrases and slogans that are simplistic exaggerations of things, like blaming everything on patriarchy. I made a list. Blaming everything on patriarchy or privilege, or saying those people are woke, or liberal this, or socialism that, or MAGA supporters, fill in the blank, or you know what I'm getting at. And this is, I mean, I didn't, my list is very, very long. Just go through the list of whatever is the contemporary catchphrase of the various polls here, right and left. I'm suggesting if you want a more honest relationship with what's true, stop using these words, or if you're going to use them, say what you mean by them. Take the next step and say, this is what I mean by these things, instead of using them as a blanket way of scapegoating or creating an us versus them dualistic world that's small. Say, no, I'd like to get toward the truth. So if I'm gonna blame MAGA supporters, what do I mean by that and who? Who? And is it a monolith? Is it not a monolith? What do we mean by these things? And isn't it possible to have a more nuanced and I think slower conversation about what's true and what's real in the world? And I think it's probably something like that. So we have some responsibility. Don't jump on the bandwagon of slogans. And if you're gonna even take one, I think do the hard work of trying to define what you think you mean by that or what is meant by that. It's funny because I think in spiritual circles, thinking gets a lot of blame, like, he's too in his head, he's ego-driven, and he spends all of his time thinking, and what we need is more heart. And there's part of me that says, okay, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of truth to that, but I wouldn't call a lot of what's happening culturally, definitely not among institutions, thinking. In fact, it's not thinking, it's just repeating phrases. So I'm saying think about words and wrestle with them, allow yourself to be confronted by words and phrases and definitions, and like a wrestling match. And okay, so here's the second point. It comes from T.S. Eliot. He says, humility is endless. He's saying, what's eternally true? Well, humility is eternally true. And that's the right kind of posture. That's Socrates, I know that I don't know. And I'm saying we need more of that. We ought to be encouraging one another to have a certain posture toward the truth, which is, I'd like to pursue it. I'd like to be in pursuit of it. I'd like to admit that I might have false beliefs, and I want to be in the business of pursuing what's true. So tell me what it's like to be you, and I'll tell you what it's like to be me, and we won't see eye to eye on things. And yet the pursuit of what is ultimately real can be a kind of compass point. Instead of what we have now, which is just mad, blind, you know, this kind of thing, plugging your ears, attempts to prove I'm right and you're wrong. And that's not serving us very well anymore. Okay. And here's the third piece. And I'm just going to read a little bit from Merton here. And that is to try to live as if the way you live is a kind of embodied truth. Another word for truth you could possibly add here, ultimate reality, would be the divine, would be God. What is ultimately the case? What is ultimately real? Reality with a capital R. That is another name for God, the mystery. And so to live, and I'm speaking sort of mystically, I suppose, to live in the truth and to know the truth, that's what Jesus says, which sets you free. You shall know the truth and truth shall set you free, is to live in relationship with the divine, with the mystery, to live a kind of embodied existence in the truth. And so here Thomas Merton is playing with, I mean, this is a very long passage. I'm just going to read a few little bits of it here. He's really pondering what he calls the will of God. And for Merton, the will of God is not like some arbitrary, you know, puppeteer God. He means something closer than to the manifestation of the divine love in all circumstances. That's kind of what he calls the will of God. And so he's saying, how do we know the will of God? I just want to read you just a few little lines here. How am I to know the will of God? He says, well, for whatever is demanded by truth, by justice, by mercy, or by love must surely be taken to be willed by God or desired by God, if you want to say it slightly differently. To consent to God's will is then to consent to be true. So we have the question of truth in the age of anxiety, and we have the question of living into what's true as best we can. And that's what he's speaking of here. To consent to the will of the divine is to consent to be true or to speak truth, or at least to seek it. There it is. That's what I was saying. That's the posture. I want to seek it. I may not know ultimately, but I want to seek it. I want to be it. I want to live it. And occasionally I'll need to speak it. And I mean, there's so much cynicism about the truth right now. It's like, I feel like I can hardly trust anything that anybody says anymore. Okay, well, how am I going to live? Can I trust what I'm saying? You know, I think just telling the truth as best you can with some humility, some epistemological humility, is the right kind of path to follow here. Are you willing to live and be and embody and inhabit the truth as best you can? Desire to move toward it. One more line here. The requirements of a work to be done can be understood as the will of God. So anything counts. Like, I don't care what your vocation is. If I'm supposed to hoe a garden or make a table, then I will be obeying the divine. If I am true to the task I am performing. So where's the truth in that? It's in the task. It's in our relationship with the task. I work with a lot of people who are struggling with their vocation and maybe are thinking of leaving their vocation. And I think one of the things that Merton is saying is here is it's not so much about vocation. It's about being true to the things that are in front of you and living them and embodying them and doing them, even making a table, true to the task. That is a relationship with what's true. And in time, if that's not what you're to be doing in the world, that will reveal itself. But in so far as you're pursuing what's true within it. To do the work carefully and well with love and respect for the nature of the task and with due attention to its purpose is to unite myself with the divine will in my work. In this way, I become the instrument of the divine and the divine works through me. This is brings us back to the question of relationship. I am then in a relational dynamic with what's ultimately true. And I'm working and something is working through me. The underground river of memory is flowing once again through me and in me, something like that. He says, unnatural, frantic, anxious work, work done under the pressure of greed or fear or any other inordinate passion, cannot properly speaking be dedicated to the divine, to God, because God never wills such work directly. And think about this list, unnatural, frantic, anxious work, work done under the pressure of greed or fear or any other inordinate passion. Doesn't that summarize the age of anxiety? He's saying you can let that go. And you can, as best you can, live into the truth of your own work, of your own parenting, of your own life, of your own speech, of your own humility, of your own honesty as best you can, of your desire to pursue the truth. So I don't know what you heard today, a hint, a guess, a clue for your own wild unfolding. What will you do with your one wild and precious life, says Mary Oliver. Maybe today I'm feeling like I'd like to live and tell the truth as best I can. See you next week.
Thank you for joining us. To make a donation, head to eastlakecc.com/donate.